Welcome to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. I'm Ankit Panda from New York.
And I'm Zachary Kak from Washington.
And we have a lot going on in Asian diplomacy this week, so we'll be devoting this podcast to two topics. First, we'll be focusing on recent diplomacy at the APEC leaders meeting in Beijing, particularly after weeks of will-they-won't-they drama. Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, and Shinzo Abe, the prime minister of Japan, shook hands. And they really didn't look that happy to be shaking hands, but Zach and I will kind of look into what this means for relations between Japan and China in the coming months and over the next year. And we'll be devoting the second part of this podcast actually to North Korea's recent charm offensive. Specifically, last week, U.S. Director of National Intelligence James Clapper out of nowhere traveled to North Korea and ended up coming back with Kenneth Bay and Matthew Todd Miller, two American citizens that had been detained by the North Korean regime. So we'll look into why exactly North Korea might have done that and what this could mean for the relationship between the United States and North Korea and North Korea's broader position in the international community. Zach, let's talk a bit about this handshake between Xi and Abe. One of the questions that had been lurking beforehand is what concessions would Japan have to make in order to make this handshake happen? And so far, it seems like we're pretty certain that Abe must have made some major concessions to get this meeting with Xi. However, when it comes to the issue of the Senkaku dispute, I hear that you have some interesting intelligence about that. Could you just tell us what you know about the situation?
I'm not sure it's intelligence, but after they released China and Japan released a statement on Friday, about a 4-point statement about the relationship. 1 point was dedicated to the Senkaku Islands, and a Japanese official emailed me after that statement was released. It said, "I would like to share our understanding of the statement with you. We did not give in to the Chinese demand of acknowledging the existence of a territorial dispute over the Senkakus. The key sentence is very carefully worded. Both sides recognized that they had different views as the emergence of tense situations in recent years in the waters of the East China Sea, including those around the Senkaku Islands. The key is recognize that they had different views as to the emergence of tense situations in recent years. We did not recognize any difference on our positions over the Senkakus. We acknowledge simply that we had different views of the cause of the tensions in the water. We think it is because of Chinese provocative activity. Sovereignty is not mentioned precisely because of this." And that contrasted with the Chinese statement, which said they acknowledge different positions on territorial issues regarding the South China Sea. So they were basically, the two parties, I guess, agreed to disagree, and they released statements to appease their domestic audiences mainly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, still, it seems like for Japan to get this meeting, it seems like China got to the point where they essentially thought that this period of frozen and cold relations with Japan had really yielded them all it could. And this was essentially the time to see what they could get out of Japan in terms of diplomatic concessions and set up this meeting with Xi and Abe. Specifically, it seems like Abe at least told the press that when he met with Xi, he brought up the issue of a maritime communication mechanism to prevent any sort of misunderstanding or escalation around the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands. What do you make of that?
I'm a little skeptical. I mean, I'm a little skeptical because I don't think this is necessarily, I mean, there's obviously always a risk of miscalculation, but I don't think that's primarily the concern here. I think in some ways China's been almost courting so-called miscalculation. It's engaging. It does this in the South China Sea too, where it, and with the intercepts of the U.S. Jets, where it kind of courts like close calls and engages in a game of chicken and stuff. So I don't see miscalculation as the key factor here. I think it's more deliberate Chinese policy to change facts on the ground. What about you?
No, I mean, I actually completely agree with that. I mean, they already have a hotline and there is a good amount of communication. So I really don't. Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, at this point, we don't really know the specifics of what this mechanism might entail. But still, I mean, I'm with you on the same page here. You know, one issue I think that's worth bringing up is that even even with this whole Xi Abe meeting and all this, you know, diplomacy going on at the ministerial level between Japan and China, I think, yes, we will see relations grow slightly more normal and less cool than they maybe were in 2013. But still, I mean, the fundamental issues that are keeping China and Japan apart, particularly as long as Abe is in power in Tokyo, are the issues of, you know, sort of historical revisionism, Japanese nationalism, and the broader historical issues that keep China and Japan apart. And there really seem to be no efforts on either side to really address that. And I think that's something that Abe and more conservative members of the LDP in Japan are not going to budge on. What do you make of that? Do you agree?
Yeah, I don't think that they're going to budge on that issue. But I think that many people in China do feel that way. But I think mainly the Chinese elites are using that as a way to distract attention from their own. They keep saying that Japan's like Abe's attitude towards history shows that Japan's like trying to change the status quo. I really think this is kind of like pulling the wool over our heads, like where China's really changing the status quo, and it's playing to Abe to distract from that fact. I think the main issue is really the Senkaku Islands. I think, you know, the Chinese elites have the ability to whip up nationalistic hysteria if they want to, or they have the ability to tone it down. We published a piece on this not too long ago on The Diplomat, and then so, I mean, I don't know if that's really the main issue, but it's going to be – next year's going to be tense because although I think tensions will cool down and there'll be a thaw in relations after this meeting, there it's the the 50th or 60th anniversary – 70th anniversary of the end of World War II, so in August. So I think that there'll be a lot of pressure on Abe to visit the shrine and stuff like that. So we could see another flare-up over that next year.
Yeah, absolutely. There is, again, the issue of visits to the Yasukuni Shrine. I mean, I also want to focus on, you know, Abe as an individual. I mean, I've said in the past that, you know, I really didn't see China-Japan relations making any real progress as long as Abe was in charge in Tokyo, simply because Abe represents everything that the current CCP elite abhor about Japanese politics. I mean, you'll recall before this Abe-Shi meeting occurred, I mean, it was primarily due to Yasuo Fukuda, who is, again, another LDP politician. However, he's not quite radical to the extent that Abe might be. You know, he did a lot of the groundwork, at least laid out a lot of the groundwork leading to this meeting. And I think that, you know, it might simply take a new face in Japanese politics in the position of prime minister to really lead to a true normalization between Japan and China. I mean, obviously, the issue of the Senkaku Islands is very strategically pertinent right now for both countries and has been since Japan nationalized them in 2012. But Abe himself, I think, stands for a lot of things that the regime in Beijing is simply not willing to work with.
Yeah, I think also from Japan's perspective, in fact, I know from Japan's perspective from talking to some officials from their side that they see Xi as fundamentally different from any Chinese leader they've seen since like Mao in terms of like, you know, Hu Jintao like didn't assert, you know, wasn't as assertive on the regional and global stage. And they see a fundamental change happening when Xi took over. In fact, Xi was running the a leading group on the East China Sea before he even took over the party in November 2012. So, I mean, Japan sees Xi as different kind of a new type of Chinese leader, so for lack of a better word.
Yeah, for sure. I think there's important things about the personalities on both sides of this thing. You're right.
And I would note that they're both like the same leader, technically. I mean, they both like come from like, you know, they're both princelings basically, and they both grew up in the elites, and they very much come from the establishment. So in that sense, I mean, they're a lot more similar in terms of their background than I would say like either of them are to like Modi or Jowaki, or what's the new Indonesia?
Jokowi. Yeah. Yeah, that's actually really interesting. I think that has led to, you know, both of these leaders carrying a significant burden of nationalism with them. I mean, especially for Abe, whose grandfather Kishi played a major part in rebuilding Japan after the Second World War and economic revival. I think there definitely is that aspect where both of these leaders see themselves as, you know, standing for the legacies of their country's political establishments. And I think that also makes them particularly, difficult to it makes it particularly difficult for the two of them to work together.
Yeah, I agree. And that picture, can we just say that picture is worth a thousand words? That
absolutely. Yeah, whoever that photographer was, he just caught the perfect expressions on both their faces. Yeah, I think I saw someone say on Twitter that they just look like two children who'd been fighting and were forced to make up by their parents. That is exactly what that reminded me of. Yeah, that's actually a remarkable photograph. I think it's going to be featured on many, you know, top 10 of Asia lists at the end of this year. Especially if we do one, I know that'll be one of my go-to pictures from this year. It's going to be incredibly memorable. Anyways, you want to take this discussion over to North Korea now?
Yeah.
All right. So like I said at the beginning of the podcast, there was a little bit of a diplomacy last week between the United States and North Korea. Well, not diplomacy exactly. I mean, James Clapper is the director of national intelligence. He's a former military officer, not quite known for his diplomatic chops. But anyways, he was pegged by the president for this mission to North Korea. And he came back with two Americans that have been the subject of a lot of media scrutiny in the United States, Matthew Todd Miller and Kenneth Bay. He returned with them. And there's been a lot of speculation as to why North Korea did this, ranging from the recent United Nations human rights inquiry and the possibility of an ICC referral for Kim Jong-un on one hand. Others have been saying that Beijing played a role in setting this up before the APEC summit. And also, there are also hints that this could be there could have been some backdoor diplomacy between the Obama administration and the North Korean government, which the Obama administration has actually been vehemently denying, saying that this is not going to lead to a revival of the six-party talks. That's still going to come down to North Korea making major concessions on denuclearization. So, Zach, I know you're interested in North Korea very much. Where do you fall down on these lines of speculation as to why North Korea decided to play ball with the United States?
I don't think there's necessarily one. I think it's possible that more than one explanation's at work here, but I would say the China one is one I find more convincing. I just don't think that Kim Jong-un feels that much – is that scared about the ICC, and I also don't know if the ICC – I mean, is this really going to stop the ICC? I mean, the ICC report wasn't about them taking Americans. It was about them – the conditions inside for North Koreans. So I think it's more probably – it just seems like – an awfully big coincidence that this happened right before the APEC meeting. So I think it could be a China playing a back behind the scenes role, and then also, you know, North Korea trying to get back on China's good side.
I think that is a real possibility. It sort of goes against, I think, what I've been reading most people being saying about, you know, North Korea-China relations. I think the general perception is that they've been on the downswing ever since, you know, Jang Song-taek's execution. But really, I mean, we don't know where the two of them stand. I mean, obviously, there's been very little high-level contact between the two sides. Kim Jong-un still hasn't visited Beijing. North Korean press and the regime have, you know, publicly called out China. I think last year they called it a turncoat and their enemy directly.
And the enemy.
Yeah, and the enemy. But I think that could be very interesting if we are seeing the two countries repairing their relations again and returning to that sort of normal state of affairs where China is North Korea's largest benefactor.
I'm not disputing that there's been a very big rift in the North Korean-Chinese relationship. I think that's completely true. But I just think that, you know, part of this rift was that North Korea won't follow China's lead on things. So I think that maybe China pushed on this, and this is one thing they gave in to try to improve relations with China.
Yeah. I mean, also, you know, you look at a lot of the other aspects of North Korea's charm offensive with other countries. It seemed like when relations with China declined, North Korea's relationship with other countries ended up improving. I mean, I'd point to, obviously, I think the biggest example here is its recent diplomacy with Japan over the abductees issue, where there was a good deal of high-level diplomacy between the two sides. Obviously, I think the United States is operating with a completely different set of constraints and interests than Japan was. The abductees issue was a huge issue in Japan politically for the government. The United States, I mean, the issue of these two prisoners, while it had received a lot of media attention, it carries nowhere near the same level of urgency for the administration.
But I mean, this isn't going to necessarily. I mean, the U.S. doesn't necessarily want to see this lead to a resumption of six-party talks. So we'll see. But it might. It's going to be increasingly hard for them to resist, I think.
A return to the six-party talks, you mean?
Yeah, because I just think there's too many. There's too many people. All the other parties seem to want us to restart it. So I think the U.S. is going to be hard-pressed to continue to resist opening up these talks. And then also there seems to be a lot of people in the U.S. There's an article, I think it was in Defense News Today, or maybe – I think it was actually like the AFP or AP or something, that about basically having all these U.S. experts criticizing Obama's strategic patience policy towards North Korea and saying that it only serves North Korea's interests. So I think there's going to be pressure on domestically for China, for domestically within like the American North Korea watchers community to reopen talks with North Korea. And I think there's definitely going to be pressure from the other five parties to six-party talks. And we'll see if the U.S. can hold out, but I just think it's going to be hard for it to.
Yeah, I think a telling sign of it will be to see if North Korea pops up on the radar when Obama and Xi meet later this week. I think that'll be a very telling sign, because I think it will require the U.S. and China to arrive at the same page on North Korea to move forward.
Yeah, we should note that, I mean, with the Republicans taking over Congress, there's not really going to be much, I don't know how much leeway Obama's going to have, even if there is a breakthrough of some sort.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up too. It seems like his next 2 years in office are going to be colored by a good deal of inaction on foreign policy.
Well, I mean, on some issues he'll have more backing, like we've talked about on the site, but I think on this, I mean, especially if you could see an Iran deal concluded, he's going to need all his political capital and engaging rogue states to deal with the Iran issue, and then to throw North Korea in the mix is going to be tough. Although, we should note that Bill Clinton had some real big breakthroughs with North Korea in his last year in office, so you never know. North Korea seems to pick the most inopportune times to engage the U.S. So.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's very possible this will happen.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for listening to the podcast. We'll probably be back next week to discuss the outcome of the meeting that's coming up between Obama and Xi, which is going to be a follow-up to the sort of Sunnyland-style dialogue. A more informal session for the two leaders to discuss U.S.-China relations. Thanks a lot for listening.
Thank you.